It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why elections in Wisconsin ranked near the top in a new national report. We'll talk with a guest about what we might be doing right and what he thinks the state could still improve on.
First, the legalization of marijuana is making headlines as states around the country, even counties within Wisconsin, vote on it. Our next guest is a public health historian who's taking a look back at how our society's views of drugs, alcohol, and tobacco have changed over time.
Virginia Barrage is with us now. She's the author of the new book, Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs. She's a professor of history and director of the Center for History and Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at the University of London. Virginia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I think a lot of us, whenever and wherever we live, have an assumption that the laws we have related to things like alcohol, tobacco, and drugs are based on how inherently harmful those substances are. As you write, it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more about what we think about those things. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. I mean, in the book, I talk about how those substances, alcohol, opium, tobacco, once occupied almost like a common culture of use, where their use was acceptable in society. And the reason they've moved apart is for reasons other than the simple dangers of the substances themselves. There are a whole host of other issues which have impacted on them. The impact of technology and technical change, things like the development of the Bonsack machine, which made mass production of cigarettes possible by comparison with the development of the hypodermic syringe, which made a much more medical response to drugs the normal way. The different role of professional groupings, social movements, and also the role of fear. Who's using those substances and what sort of groups in society they're connected with. So all of those issues have had an impact on the substances in a different way.
Let's follow the story of opium a little bit. You write, mainly focusing on Britain, but it was true here in the United States, that in the 19th century and a little bit beyond, opium was pretty widely available in things like patent medicines and syrups and this and that. How widespread was just everyday opium usage?
Well, I think it was everyday opium use because you have to think back to a time when, you know, most people weren't going to their doctor, their physician. They didn't have the money probably to do that, or a physician wasn't available. So most of the treatment would have been self-medication in one form or another. There wasn't the knowledge of specific disease that developed later on. And so opium was a kind of cure-all for everything. You know, it dealt with headaches, it dealt with cholera, it dealt with you name it. It was something that everyone had in their medicine cabinet at the time.
What were some of the earliest concerns with hazards of opium in that sort of daily usage?
Well, I think people were concerned about the drug being adulterated, not being very pure. Lots of things were added to it. You never knew quite what standard you were getting when you bought it over the counter, and that made it very uncertain in the action that it would have. So lots of reports of opium overdoses, opium poisoning. So that was one quite big problem.
So that patent medicine bottle here might have a low dose, and the one right next to it with the same label might have an overdose in it.
Overdose, yes. Yeah, there was no kind of standardization. I mean, the other thing that people were concerned about was the dosing of children. Opium being used to keep children quiet. And there were lots of children's quietness, things like Godfrey's cordial, streets, infant quietness, things like with these sorts of names, were on the market at the time. And it was kind of the norm to give these to children. And there was a lot of concern about that, too.
And you mentioned the rise of fear and drugs being associated with particular groups. You write about the rise of the reality and more so the concept of the opium den run especially by Chinese people in London. It's almost like it's a trope that keeps coming up in literature again and again.
Yeah, I think, you know, if a substance is used by somebody who isn't you or me, you know, who's different in some way, or somebody who seems to be kind of deviant in some sort of way, is perceived in that way by commentators, then it's much easier to bring it under rigorous control. And that's what happened in relation to Chinese use, which was really blown out of all proportion, I think. People who watched the Chinese smoking, who knew something about the culture, said, well, this is really just like the Chinese equivalent of a social club. But the way it was portrayed in literature and in the sort of weekly magazines of the time made it seem something much more threatening and dangerous.
And that's a theme that keeps coming up again and again, whether it's Chinese people in London with opium, immigrants in the United States with alcohol, marijuana for a long time associated with African Americans, often urban decay type settings. Why is this the thing that keeps turning us toward banning substances, toward prohibition of various drugs?
Well, I think it's if a substance is associated with a kind of, you know, a group that's seen as different in society, then people are somewhat fearful of it. Also, I think there's always a fear that that group is going to somehow infect the rest of society. And that was one of the concerns in Victorian Britain, that lower class use, whatever sort it was going to undermine the whole of society. It was going to undermine respectable society as well.
And when does that start to translate from a concern, a public concern, moral concern, into laws? And we can come up pretty close to the present day with the crack cocaine epidemic here in the United States, again associated with African Americans in the public eye, and again leading to laws that targeted drugs African Americans used more than ones everybody else used.
Yes. Well, I guess, you know, the first kind of restrictions that were put on the statute book were restrictions under the pharmacy laws, which restricted drugs so that they could only be sold by pharmacists. They couldn't just be sold over the counter by any corner shop. So they had to be sold by a professional person, a pharmacist. And then restriction increased during and after the First World War. A whole system of international legal control of drugs was set up. It had been on the cards before the First World War, but it really only came into operation as an international system after that war. And it was under that system that America put into operation, for example, the Harrison Act, which was first passed in 1914, which served to very severely restrict the use of opiates.
Why does a society decide to ban, say, opium and other drugs that are now illegal and not things like alcohol and tobacco? Is there something inherent in alcohol or tobacco, or is it something else?
Well, I guess alcohol and tobacco originally were part of that same, you know, kind of mainstream culture that also had opium as part of it. But the sort of issues that I talk about in the book impacted differently on alcohol, for example, and also on tobacco as well. For example, the role of technology and technical change. With alcohol, that brought the possibility of mass production, and the same was true of tobacco with the coming of the Bonsack machine and the mass production of cigarettes. So with alcohol, you got a kind of mass culture of use, whereas with the opiates, it was a much more medicalized and restricted culture. And certainly during the First World War, although there was restriction, there was never a subsequent system of international control of alcohol. Obviously, in America, you had prohibition, but prohibition was relatively short-lived. It didn't last long as a countrywide system.
We're talking to author Virginia Berridge about her new book, Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs. And we want to hear from you on this. How have you seen attitudes towards various drugs, alcohol, tobacco, change in the course of your lifetime? Why do you think some substances are more socially and legally acceptable than others? Do you see maybe some of the ones that are now illegal becoming legal in the near future? Some of the ones that are currently legal being more regulated? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email at talk@WPR.org. We continue our discussion now about how attitudes change over time toward things like alcohol, tobacco, and the long list of drugs that are illegal currently, opium, marijuana, cocaine, and others, how they change through history. Our guest is author Virginia Berridge. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Call in now and tell us how you've seen attitudes toward drugs, alcohol, and tobacco change in your lifetime. Why do you think some things are more socially acceptable than others? Why are some legal, some illegal? Why do attitudes change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Virginia, speaking of changing attitudes, not long ago in the history of both of our countries, smoking was very common. Indoor smoking, taken for granted. Nobody really thought twice about it. Somebody at that time, would anybody have ever predicted that there'd come a day where we'd be banning smoking in all sorts of indoor locations?
No, I think back in the, say, the 1950s, when the connection between smoking and lung cancer was first being discussed, I think it would have been absolutely inconceivable that the position that we've got to today would have happened, because at the time smoking was so embedded in culture. The vast majority of people did smoke. It was just the norm. So there's been that huge cultural change, which has taken, you know, several decades to achieve.
And what had to change in public attitudes before there could start to be political action to start to restrict the use of tobacco?
Well, I think this is one of the things. Certainly the politicians in the UK were very concerned about restricting smoking because of the electoral implications that this might have. They were very worried because smokers were voters, and voters wouldn't be too happy about being restricted in something which was one of their main pleasures in life. So this was a lot of what the debate focused on in the 1950s and the 1960s. And it was only when smoking began to become less central in society that politicians, I think, were willing to shift their stance slightly.
And that's interesting. That's going from a legal substance to regulated. On the other hand, politicians can be worried if they start rethinking drugs that are currently illegal. In fact, you start by telling the story of a researcher, a government researcher, who lost his job ultimately because of comparing the harms and not some people not liking what they found. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, well, this was David Nutt, who was chair of the main British government's advisory committee on drugs, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. And he and some colleagues got together and developed a table of the actual harms of substances as opposed to the ways in which they're legally restricted. And of course, alcohol and tobacco came up much higher than some of the illicit drugs. And he then gave a talk which compared the dangers of horse riding with the dangers of taking ecstasy, and it was called ecstasy, and that was just going a bit too far, I think, and he lost his job as the chair of that committee. But this call for a kind of more rational response to the way substances are categorized and regulated has reverberated. It's been much discussed in the UK, and it's one of the reasons that I decided to write the book, because I wanted to argue that, in fact, those substances had been regulated according to particular historic reasons rather than in any kind of rational sort of way.
We'll bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Joe with us in Spring Valley. Joe, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I want to comment on the use of opiates and the dangers of them. I started using opiates from a simple dental trip, and due to the dentist not being able to see me, he kept me on the painkillers. My body became addicted to them, very addicted to them. He then cut me off them. I started doctor shopping, and then that began a long, hard road of drug seeking and eventually turning to heroin. And lost several friends from overdoses. I lost my sister, Tammy, from a drug overdose to heroin. And, you know, there's a lot of young people now using heroin. And I just want to say to people out there that there's other alternatives to this. And, you know, I have grave concerns about the use of opiates.
All right, Joe. I want to bring our guest on this, but I'm very sorry for your losses, Joe, and good luck to you in dealing with this. Virginia, he brings up. I mean, the opiates are a very strange category. They're illegal in a way, but they're also available in prescription form. How are societies trying to juggle that difficult balancing act?
Well, I guess you know that's something that they've managed over a long period because. Certainly in the UK, heroin has retained its use as a very effective painkiller used to alleviate the pain of terminal cancer and so on. So it's had that medical usage, but it's also had that illicit usage as well. There have been attempts to ban heroin altogether for medical use in the past, but that's certainly not happened in the UK. So, yeah, that's a difficult balance to maintain. Sometimes one spills over into the other.
And talking about drugs in the language of addiction or being victimized by drugs, that's fairly new, isn't it?
Yes. Certainly back in the 19th century, people didn't talk about, you know, disease or addiction. They talked about somebody having a bad habit, maybe, but not in the way we use the term habit today.
Like spitting on the sidewalk is a bad habit or something
like that. Yes, yes. It's like, you know, doing something that you shouldn't do, but, you know, it was okay, you know, not too bad. And the idea of treating somebody, actually giving them treatment, was also something that wasn't normal. You know, it wasn't the automatic kind of response to somebody who had this habit. And it was only really towards the end of the 19th century that it became much more normal to talk about disease. People talked about inebriety, which was the disease of either alcohol or drug use. They talked about morphinomania or morphinism. And gradually, a more kind of stable terminology developed. People started to talk later on about alcoholism, and they started to talk about addiction when they meant illicit drug use. But certainly, really, until the early years of the 20th century, it wasn't the normal thing to talk about disease and treatment, and it was really quite difficult to establish any kind of system, any kind of regular system, where people did actually access treatment.
Well, you end your book venturing into dangerous territory for a historian, the future. You paint a couple possible paths we might take when it comes to the drugs we're talking about. What are those paths?
Well, one of the things I talk about is the way the substances, they don't kind of stop in the position which they've arrived at. I mean, history is constantly happening and evolving. And so some of the boundaries around substances have been changing in recent times. For example, the changes around cannabis, marijuana, the medicalization of cannabis, the medical uses of some drugs that are illicit, and the kind of recreational use of other sorts of drugs like the cognition enhancers. So I just really point to a future where we could be living in a much more hedonistic society, where taking drugs and taking substances of all sorts is much more normal and acceptable. Or the other alternative is where we move to a much more restrictive and regulated society, where there's a harsher attitude towards taking those substances. And I point to, some trends seem to lead in one direction and some in another, and it's difficult to say exactly where we'll end up in the future.
Well, the history is still happening. Virginia, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
That's Virginia Berridge. She's the author of Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs, and she's a professor at the University of London.